These are the stories that you need to know about today. There is infighting among European elites. What's that signal? Are Kaja Kallas and Ursula von der Leyen involved? I will tell you. The EU tries for the 110th time to destroy Russia's economy, with this time a new move upcoming. But will that end up destroying Europe itself?
Do you feel any responsibility as a Jew in the current climate, where there's a rise in anti-Semitism and people blame Jews for everything, saying they want to control the world, and when they need evidence, they point to you?
The guy being peppered with questions is Larry Fink. He's the most powerful man in the world. He's getting finked on the Sanchez effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is The Effect. The situation for Europe has gotten really bad these days. How bad is it? Well, we've talked about this throughout the week, but you've probably heard the reports of corruption with the EU. Now there are also reports of infighting with the EU. That's kind of stuff you hear in soap operas, right? Including one report suggesting a catfight between the EU's foreign minister, Kaja Kallas, where she called her boss, Ursula von der Leyen, a dictator. There's another report also filed by Politico where Kallas was overheard saying that things have gotten so bad it may be, quote, time to start drinking. Drinking. Here's what the article says.
EU top diplomat Kaja Kallas summed up what many were thinking when she quipped privately that the state of the world makes it, quote, a good moment to start drinking. She might not have intended it as a serious assessment, but it offered a telling insight. Europe's representative on the global stage thinks that things are looking pretty dire.
Yeah, and when she says pretty dire, it's pretty dire fact is especially dire for the EU, for NATO. Their Ukraine experiment to try and collapse or destroy Russia has failed. It's backfired. And paradoxically, that which it hoped to destroy, it has actually helped to make stronger. Russia. European citizens have started to notice this. They've noticed the problems with the EU. They've noticed the problems with their own leaders. They've noticed the problems with NATO. And those citizens have started to scream, I told you so.
The Nord Stream energy infrastructure was simply blown up right under our noses. I can tell you what we'll do when we're in government. We'll demand compensation. Then simply let the Ukrainians and Zelensky pay for blowing up our pipelines.
Wow. Did you hear that applause? I mean, that's real. That's sentiment. That's a gut check, right? In Germany, no less, where the people seem fed up. They're angry as they turn on their own government officials, people like Friedrich Merz, for sending tons of billions of dollars of their money, their tax money, right, to Ukraine. Bye-bye. Now they say they want it back. And they want Ukraine to pay for blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline. Side note, that was Biden and the CIA. Wink. But I digress. Here is more of this woman, this feisty woman, Alice Weidel, from Germany's most, by far, this is important, by far, Germany's most popular political party right now, the AfD.
We have invested 70 billion euros in their country. We have supplied them with so many weapons, sending German tanks against Russia. Are we serious? How could anyone have thought of such a thing? And I repeat, we will demand that the billions spent be returned to us.
There you go. We want our money back. Applause. Look, Europe's problem is not just its failed Ukraine strategy. Nope. There's something worse for Europe right now that's become an even bigger problem. The U.S. It's Europe's sugar daddy is bailing on them. Ciao. Paca. Adios, amigo. You're on your own. That's pretty much what Trump is saying to Europe right now. That's the new reality for Europe. Their new reality that they're having to deal with. And it's not easy. It would lead a lot of people to drinking. not just Kayakalas. So what does the EU do? What should they do in this situation, right? It's a good question, because they've done something. Instead of trying to mend fences with, let's say, okay, the United States doesn't want to be our partner, maybe we'll turn to China. Or maybe we turn, let's say, to, how about Russia? By the way, Russia in the past supplied Europe with cheap energy, efficient, cheap energy supplies, hydrocarbons, gas to heat their homes, to run their businesses. So what is Europe doing in this predicament they're in? They're firing off and they're doing something else. They're doing the opposite of what many would say they should do.
We reached a provisional agreement on the Commission's proposal to fully phase out Russian fossil fuels. We're turning that page, and we're turning it for good. This is the dawn of a new era, the era of Europe's full energy independence from Russia.
There she is. That is the EU's Ursula von der Leyen, announcing a complete ban from now on all Russian gas, effective 2027. Some are calling this a one-woman obsession to hurt Russia, to destroy Russia, one that will likely end up hurting Europeans, the citizens of Europe. And here's why. Let me explain it to you. Since the war and since the sabotage of Nord Stream pipeline, Europe hasn't stopped denouncing Russia and its gas and everything else about it. But, big but here, it has still continued to find a way to buy gas from Russia, import gas, even if not directly from Russia. It has been unable to go without it. Look at this graphic. $218 billion it's still spending on Russian gas. The only difference is it is paying more to acquire it by getting it from diverted sources. It goes, for example, from Russia, right? And then the gas goes to India or the oil where it's refined, and then it makes its way back to Europe. Going through all this rigmarole tells us just how much Europe still needs Russia's gas, even if it has to pay inflated prices, or the people do, the citizens do, the businesses do. So what does the EU do now? It is now announcing that it will effectively ban all Russian gas, effective 2027. That's interesting, isn't it? Because if you think this through, if the plan is to damage Russia, that's not going to work. Russia will be fine because Russia has more gas than any country in the world, and certainly plenty of buyers, including the two most populous countries in the world, China and India. In fact, soon the Siberia 2 pipeline will simply redirect Russia's oil and gas that used to go to Europe straight to China through Mongolia. So here's what's interesting about all of this, because now you got to ask yourself. So this thing we just saw this woman von der Leyen do, right? Who is that really going to hurt, right? Who will be hurt while Europe buys more expensive gas that has to go through transoceanic ships from thousands of miles away, which is going to double, maybe triple what Europeans are paying for gas now, certainly compared to what they paid for Russian gas that used to be delivered to them more efficiently through pipelines? So who's going to pay? The people of Europe. That's who. The people who live in Europe. They're already paying some of the most expensive energy prices and have the most expensive energy bills of any place in the world. And now, because of this, they'll likely end up paying even more. So who's von der Leyen and the EU benefiting, if not their own people? Bankers, investors, big tech companies, energy companies, those are the people who are now going to, Western energy companies in particular, those are the people who are going to benefit from selling these Western, or buying these Western resources and exporting them into Europe. These are the people who are going to make good on this, right? People like this man. See that guy? That's Larry Fink. Arguably, he is the most powerful man in the world. He certainly runs the most powerful company in the world. If you haven't guessed it by now, the company he runs is BlackRock. It manages almost 14 trillion, I can't believe I'm saying this, $14 trillion in assets. That's bigger than most countries. Its plan, BlackRock's plan, was to own and run Ukraine. Just as many could argue that they kind of own and run the people who run the EU and many European elites, who, by the way, worked for BlackRock. I could name them. Larry Fink is, he's not a good person. He's not a good person, which is, maybe it's impossible to be a good person when you run that company, which is why he's rarely seen on, you know, TV. He doesn't make a lot of appearances. But I'll tell you what, he showed up in Davos. He does this once a year usually, and he got an earful. What you're about to see that we have here for you is a kind of a great moment. I think we can almost call this our moment of shame.
Why are you so quiet? What does spirit of dialogue actually mean, Larry? Does it mean anything? Is it like pretending you care about the carbon footprint coming here on a private jet?
Why is your bodyguard pushing me into the street, sir?
I'm just asking you to keep your distance.
Why was the would-be assassin of Donald Trump in one of your corporate videos, sir? Isn't that a bit weird?
Do you feel any responsibility as a Jew in the current climate where there's a rise in anti-Semitism and people blame Jews for everything, saying they want to control the world, and when they need evidence, they point to you? You're the example every anti-Semite gives, and it's hard to fight.
How do you feel about Donald Trump saying you can no longer buy up residential homes and rent them out for profit? Did you talk to him about that? Do you agree with him that you've been predatory in your pricing for residential houses in America?
A lot of those are really good questions, you know? I mean, it's like watching Muhammad Ali, you know, jab, jab, jab. He's being peppered. He's not answering any of the questions, of course. But maybe he should. And maybe we should live in a world where guys like this have to answer those kinds of questions from regular people. All right, joining me now live to go through this is Dr. Jean Oberg. He's the director of the Independent Transactional Foundation for Peace and Future Research in Sweden. I mean, this is a man who has been involved in facilitating the types of issues that we have been discussing, those things that I just talked about, some of those difficult questions that a lot of people have to find solutions for. This is what he has done, looking for solving these kinds of things in conflicts like the one in Iraq and the one in Yugoslavia. He's been to China many times. So, doctor, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much. Just to correct you, it's Transnational Foundation, not transactional.
That's my mistake.
No problem.
My fault. No, but just goes to show how incredibly imperfect I am. Something my wife reminds me of all the time, by the way.
And my wife reminds me that I'm a pedantic, so.
That's a good one. That's a great way to start. All right, let's start with the EU. They're in a bit of a pickle. What are they going to do? Mr. Trump is saying, I don't like you guys anymore, and I'm going to move on from you. They've already kind of ostracized the Chinese, and they seem to, in every turn, tell the Russians how much they hate them. So what do they do now? What would you do if you were advising Ursula von der Leyen?
Oh, I would start earlier and say, of course, this is all has all been a cover-up of the completely stupid and irrational expansion of NATO against all promises given to Gorbachev. Mm. And also, if you did, you know, Montenegro and Croatia or whatever, you should never have tried to do Ukraine. So there's been a cover-up since that happened and since you had the regime changed by the Obama administration in Kiev, the building up of the army and all that. And that is a consequence of what you see. What you see now is the consequences of this. But let me go back in history.
Okay.
I was in Iraq doing a fact-finding mission and writing a book before the invasion. And the former French ambassador, former Iraqi ambassador to France, told me that they thought, this was before the bombing and invasion, that they thought that it was impossible to talk to the Washington. So they wanted to talk with the European Union. And they had written several letters and not getting any answers. And my point is, the EU, I've written two books, small books about it. The EU was never geared to do something different from the United States. It's not geared, although it's in the preamble of the Lisbon Treaty, that it should work for peace inside itself and in the world. There's no structural thinking. There's no institutions. There's no philosophy that would permit the European Union to do anything, but basically, with small divergence, basically do what the Americans are telling them to do. And these ruthless people in Washington have decided that we don't care about Ukraine anymore because we got the resources of Ukraine. That's what Trump's resource deal is about. It is that we're not interested in the country as such. We're interested in having its resources because Donald Trump is building what I call the United States of autarky. That is something that can rely on itself with tentacles everywhere, getting the resources it needs outside Gaza, in Canada, in Greenland, Venezuela, etc. Because it knows somehow that you cannot rule the world anymore and do what you did before. So Europe could have, has had the last 25 years to do something else and shape an intelligent foreign policy with, of course, Western countries, too. The most stupid thing is the way the European Union is now handling Russia, of course, and that's all emotionalism. There's no analysis, no rationality. I'd like to come back to that.
Yeah.
But also China. I mean, I work in China. I work with China. I'm fascinated with what they do. By the way, that's the only country in the world that has a long-range vision of where it wants to go. If you ask a European leader, where do you want your country or the Union to be in 20 years from now, you'll get blaha. Or you'll get Kala saying that she wants to drink instead. You know, that's where.
They're in a unique position. They're in an enviable position. Every place in the world kind of romances Europe. They all see themselves as Europeans. They all want to be in Europe. They all want a vacation in Europe. So if ever there has been an opportune moment, it seems to me, Doctor, for the Europeans to be expansive, to go beyond where they've always been and to say, okay, you know what? We've been tied at the hip to the Americans for so long, but this is a great opportunity for us to reach out. We're going to reach out to the Russians. We're going to reach out to the Chinese. And we're not going to separate ourselves from the Americans. We're going to be more universal, more expansive. If ever there's been a time to do it, it's now. Why the hell aren't they?
Well, I could ask you that question because it pains my heart to see it. Because there were all opportunities. I'm old enough to remember, you know, the first Cold War, and we had leaders in Europe at that time, whether you take Charles de Gaulle, you take Wilson, Macmillan, you take Bruno Kreisky, you take Olof Palme, and one of the biggest, of course, Gorbachev and Willy Brandt. And some Danish socialists. There was a Europe that was basically developed by the social democratic parties, and they don't exist today except in name. I'm sorry. It's everything the social democratic stood for, the welfare state, equality, internationalism, support small countries when they are bullied by big ones, disarmament, common security. It's all gone. And you can ask me why it's all gone. I don't know, but there's nobody who has an intellectual mind anymore in Europe. They had it. Probably they were... They were children of or had been living through the Second World War, and they knew how dangerous war was.
Yeah.
Those you have today don't know what war is. I would like all the European leaders to go to some of the war zones I've been working in, and they would never talk about war again.
You know, I mentioned this earlier. I don't know if you caught a little bit of my monologue, but I get a sense that these people, you mentioned some big names in the past in Europe, people I grew up reading about. But now the people who are there, Friedrich Merz and Macron and Starmer, and some of these guys seem to me like they're more tied to Larry Fink and bankers and those other big industrialists than they are any other country or even any other leaders of other countries. And when I look them up, when I do a ChatGPT on any of these guys, which I have, I find out they're all bankers. Some of them work for BlackRock. So now they're still kind of working for BlackRock. Am I wrong?
No, I think you can find good analysis on Substack and elsewhere where you go through the personalities. They have all been kind of, you know, affiliated with an American university, taken some courses, had a Fulbright stipend or whatever. Huh. And the same goes for our media people. Lots of those who write in the Nordic media have passed their U.S. university in Beirut and got their media education there. I mean, don't tell me that there is no conveying at the same time of American values. Most of the academics have read American textbooks. They know everything about what Americans think about international relations. They read Joseph Nye or whatever. Those of us who read other stuff have never been that fascinated with what the United States did because it's the most worrying, more militaristic country in modern civilization. And so now, finally, somebody, you know, particularly, let's say, as an example, the Danish prime minister is finally finding out that maybe she can't trust the United States as she's done blindly. I mean, why? Because suddenly somebody says, I think I want Greenland, right? I think I want Greenland. And so it makes somebody think. I mean, the rest of us have been thinking about it since Afghanistan, since the bombing of Yugoslavia, which was when NATO became a criminal organization violating its own charter.
Yes.
We've been thinking about Iraq because we've been there. We're thinking of Georgia. We've been thinking of the places. I've been to Syria. I've been to working in Iran. I know these places a little bit. I'm not an expert, but I know these places. I've seen them myself. Yeah. And we said, hey, there's one common factor in all these problems. That's interventionism and militarism and base building of the United States. Now, when I say that, which I don't do anymore in Scandinavian media because nobody wants to listen to me, people say, oh, he's anti-American. No, I've never been anti-American. I've collected American art. I love Bob Dylan and Robert Rauschenberg and all that. I've never been that. But I'm against militarism. I'm against imperialism. I'm against racism. I'm against interventionism. Stick to your own country and make it a good place. Make America great again is fine. If this is the way that Trump wants to do it, I tell you, this is fascism.
Yeah, I'm with you 100% on your reaction to the reaction that we saw from Europe just a week ago when we first started hearing their reaction to Mr. Trump wanting to take Greenland. And they were freaked out and they called it colonialism and they call it interventionism. And I was thinking, where the hell have you been? It's only intervention.
Where were you at the Gaza genocide? Excuse me. Where were you all guys in Europe?
It's amazing. Let's move on. Speaking of interventions, it looks like there's the possibility that there could be another intervention in Iran. What would you, with all your experience, advise the Iranian government to do, given that just today Mr. Trump came out and said that he's talking to them and he thinks that they're going to have a deal soon? Do you deal with Donald Trump?
Well, my perspective on Iran, I'm not an expert in Iran. I don't speak the language, et cetera, but I've been there, talked with people, given lectures. And let me say, you know, this is not a regime that I fancy. Repression of all women, for instance.
Yeah.
From at least in some points there, 60% of the university students are women, actually. So it's a kind of selective repression. But that said, the U.S. has nothing to do there. It has harassed this country since 1953, when CIA and the British Intelligence Service, funny name of somebody who was never intelligent, did a coup d'etat against Mossadegh. Yeah. And then the sanctions since 16. I've seen the results of the sanctions. It's mass murder and destroying of a society. And it destroys the middle class that could make political changes if anyone could do it, because sanctions means that somebody moves up and drives Maseratis into Iran and are hellishly rich, and the rest become proletariat. There's not a middle class anymore who can change the system. So the Americans have done everything they could to put the Iranian people in a double cage, the cage of internal repression and the outer cage of sanctions. And they have forced everybody else, including the Europeans, to not trade with Iran. That's what people forget. There's something called secondary sanctions.
Mm.
I tried it a few years ago. There was a flood catastrophe in Iran, and I wanted to send, I think it was $20 or something like that, personally, yeah, to victims of that through the Red Crescent, a humanitarian Iranian organization. My Swedish bank refused to do that. And I wrote to the board and say, are you aware of what you're doing? And I never got an answer. Because they have to. Otherwise, Treasury in Washington will put, you know, $5 billion of a fine on these banks if they do. So the Europeans have accepted to be under sanctions too, you know, for all these years. It's incredible to me. If you're a sovereign state, why do you let the United States bully and tell you who to trade with? It already started there.
Is it just a matter of time, given on what you just said? You're making me think of something I was reading this morning about this new BRICS measure to create this thing called the unit, which will kind of replace the dollar and all the machinery that surrounds the dollar and banking, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think we are close or will eventually have in this world a system that allows people to be able to do what you wanted to do, just send money to starving people and avoid having to go through a U.S. system, avoid those sanctions and those tariffs or whatever the hell those things are that the United States is putting on?
It cannot go fast enough, if you ask me. Hmm. The Americans have misused their self-appointed, representative of, no, they call themselves exceptionalists.
Oh, exceptionalists.
There are only two countries in the world who call themselves exceptionalists, and that's Israel and, to a certain extent, Japan, but particularly the U.S. We can do what the hell we want. That was what the rules-based international order was about. There was a special order for the United States that was outside the normal international law and the U.N. Charter and the norms we've built with the Geneva Conventions and all that. And so you can try to get away with that, but you cannot do it forever. So if you ask me, we're in a fantastically interesting situation. The U.S., the Western world, which is 11% of humanity, has a choice to make. Do we want to join the new world, which is multipolar, run by many in networking relations, etc.? Or do we want to keep on bullying the world, particularly because as long as we're the most, at least the one that wastes most money on the military, we can still have, you know, we're stronger than anyone. We can do things. That choice, I think, it makes a catastrophe for the United States, which I am not against in any way, because Trump does not understand that he's isolated in the United States and he's contributing to a fast demise of the Western world's leadership because of what he does. So if you ask me, we are living in a very promising time, but in the wrong way, because I believe that we will have to live together, a peaceful coexistence, as is built into the Chinese Constitution, five principles of peaceful coexistence. And that is something the United States and the Western world and NATO does not understand. So the dollar will go, NATO will fall apart, the European Union will fall apart if it doesn't shape up and do something different. And it will not be with von der Leyen and Kallas, in my view, because they are visionless people who are related to the people you talk about. And I would like to add, related to the military, industrial, media, academic complex, MIMAC. That is what rules the world, not just the banks. It is the military, industrial, media, academic complex. Eisenhower talked about it in 61. He called it the military, industrial complex. I have expanded on that because the media are there too. And the academic world is there too. All these state institutes, all these state-run media in the West. You know, if we see something from Al Jazeera or whatever on YouTube, it says this is financed by or supported by this and that government and China is a state medium and all that. I mean, what is the Danish broadcasting? What is the Swedish television? Yeah. It's state media. And they don't say anything that could be critical of their governments. If you take all the state research institutes for foreign policy, international relations institutes, They're saying nothing interesting anymore because they are not doing free research. They're doing commissioned research within a box that you can say certain things. But I don't know a scholar that sits in a state research institute who is critical of NATO. I mean, these things, unfortunately, we have crumbled the spectrum of ideas, which was not typical for the Western world. And when we do that, we are becoming more and more stupid and more ending up with the opposite of pluralism, which I don't know what you would call it, uniformism or homogeneity or whatever. Yeah. So you have a man in Europe like Jacques Bourque, who is now sanctioned by the top leadership that you talked about for having written two or whatever, three critical books about NATO's operations and the whole project of expanding NATO into Ukraine, right? The man cannot buy food. We take his money from him. There's no lawyer. There's nobody who is he's not had a chance to defend himself. He's accused of doing Russian misinformation, and that's it. I mean, if this is the way the Western world is going, I tell you, it'll go down very fast.
You're the first person, doctor, who's ever put those three together for me. I understand the military-industrial complex. I think we all do post-Eisenhower. I also understand the media's role in this because, as you probably know if you've researched me, I worked at CNN, I worked at NBC, I worked at Fox News, I worked at Univision. So I understand the interlocking that goes on there. I know who's on the board of those companies that I work for and why all of a sudden I was pressured to only report certain things and talk to certain people. What I don't understand is what you were just trying to explain to me about how it's also infiltrated our institutes of higher learning, the so-called think tanks and those kinds of things. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more so that our viewers can understand it? How have the companies that want war gotten their filthy hands into our institutes, our universities, our schools, our think tanks, et cetera?
Well, the classical thing, of course, is you are educated up in the system and you are loyal to it. And the second thing is you have in American think tanks, you have lots of people who've been at State Department or Pentagon or what now is called the Department of War, who ends up in these think tanks in the boards, and they come with their values and their ideas. If you look at, for instance, the whole accusation theory, machinery industry against China, it comes very much from a number of selected American think tanks who have constructed the story about concentration camps and genocide on all Muslims, particularly in Xinjiang, but Muslims everywhere in China. I happen to have been there, you know. I'm sorry, I didn't find concentration camps and extermination of these Muslims. I talked with too many Muslims to believe it. Now, where does it come from? Because it's in the interest. I don't know whether you know it, but the American government has set off $5 billion to train people, to get people trained in writing negative stories about the Belt and Road Initiative and China. Now, call that free media. I mean, I'm the person who is never interviewed. I was all over the media in Denmark. I'm a Danish citizen. In the 70s, 80s, and 90s, up to about 2000, commenting on things, Yugoslavia, whatever it was. Today, there's nobody who would touch me. And it's not because I've changed my views. I've always been for peace and the UN norm of making peace by peaceful means. In that sense, it's the rest who changed, because you cannot come up to a state-dominated media or the mainstream, as we call the media, and say that this could be done in a different way. Maybe we should talk with the Russians instead of arming Ukraine to fight a hopeless war against Russia and let the Ukrainians pay a price for Western ambitions. Now, if you had some moral standing in the Western world, what you would do would be to set off 300,000 or 400,000 NATO soldiers and invade Russia. Go for it then, if that's what you want. But asking the Ukrainian people to pay the price for that and then having somebody like Zelensky playing that doll's puppet on a string role is probably the most immoral project I've seen in my lifetime.
Why do you say somebody like Zelensky? What do you imply by that?
No, I mean, he's been installed like Poroshenko was installed. It was all the process that came with Obama's regime change in 2014 that everybody in the Western press denies. And if you go to the EU homepage and the NATO homepage, Gorbachev was never promised not to, that was never given the promises that we will not expand NATO. Now you have thick books of 500 pages that documents that he got these promises. We did all the bad things because we were suddenly winning the Cold War. History was over. We could do what we pleased. Our foundation argued, we just turned 40 years, so we've been here for quite some time. We argued that with the demise of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, NATO should be abolished and we should find a common security system in Europe. Hmm. Now, nobody listened to that, of course. Today, we turn out to be right because the world we're in now is in Europe. And also the economic burden of militarism and 5% of gross national product is all a consequence of the stupid decision to keep NATO when it had no longer a raison d'être. And then it started doing things like invading and bombing Yugoslavia, which is totally outside the treaty, the North Atlantic Treaty. I mean, few people have read it. It's a copy of the United Nations Charter with paragraph 5 added that, which I think is a defensive alliance. If you are attacked, I'm supposed to come and help you, right?
Yeah.
That's good. I could sign that charter. But the organization has since then only done criminal stuff by being engaged anywhere else. Yeah. And if you tell Russia that, he will deny it. If you tell everybody that, you will deny it. They will deny it. But you cannot be in denial eternally. At some point, reality catch up with you.
Bombing Belgrade and killing 1,200 people, many of them civilians, and bombing them for 3 straight months without fail. I don't see how the hell that was defensive. That seemed like it was offensive. I think it was an aggressive act by NATO.
And it's even worse, sir, if you look at the philosophy of deterrence, if you look at the right reserved for NATO to be the first to use nuclear weapons, also against the conventional attack, etc., there is no defensiveness. Unfortunately, the world, whether you take China, Russia, the US, NATO, or whatever, they all believe in deterrence, which is humanity's biggest curse. You can never make peace if you deter somebody with killing people 5,000 kilometers away if they don't do what you say. Deterrence is the wrong philosophy, and there's no defensiveness. Long-range weapons should go. Instead of fighter aircraft, we should have helicopters guarding our borders, etc. There's a whole concept, and that's one of the things I'd like to talk about, is what should a good defense system look like? And that's something I've worked with for 40 years with colleagues. You know, the only thing you can't do is to make peace with the way ministries of defense and military people think today all over the world. I'm surprised that even the Chinese do that because they are not Westerners, but they imported the whole thing. And they also have nuclear weapons, which should go. There's nothing defensive about nuclear weapons. Excuse me. I don't know of people anywhere who would like to use nuclear weapons on their own territory. It is by definition an offensive weapon because it should only be thrown on somebody else out there, right? You cannot even use the territory you've used it on because then you can't, it will be a radioactive desert. This should go. I mean, it's obvious it should go from a moral point of view, a military strategic doctrine point of view. But people still talk about we must have nuclear weapons. We can't live without it. I mean, how many thousand years of humanity existed without nuclear weapons?
It seems to me like aggression is approved of or disapproved of based on the... I'll give you an example. Let's talk about 1962 October. The United States feels like in Cuba there are missile silos. So they are essentially launching raids and preparing to bomb Cuba and, if necessary, start a war with the Soviet Union. It is seen even today as one of the greatest moments in the history of the United States. Bravado, applauded, well done, Mr. Kennedy, well done, United States. Many would argue that Russia just recently with Ukraine found itself in the very same situation where a neighboring country was going to have missiles pointed at them, and they decided to act. They warned and warned and told NATO, please don't do this. NATO failed to do it, and they eventually went in. I would ask, many would ask, what's the difference?
I completely share that parallel. The problem is that security politics should be about empathy. How will the other side react if we do A, B, and C, or C? And that does not exist because people who have no intellect think that that is the same as sympathy. The very first thing you should ask yourself is, if I do this, how will my opponent react? And they don't do that anymore. If you take the whole European Union now, NATO vis-a-vis Russia has been emotionalism. We're going to punish them. We're going to show them how angry we are. We're going to close down their media. We won't have any flights to them. We will not do this and that. It's childish, immature. It's without any analysis. I'm shocked as an academic with some stuff behind me to see that total anti-intellectualism now applied to the Western politics. And I go to China, I go to Iran, I go to other places, and I see people who think, who discuss intellectual matters, and who talks about peace. When did you last hear somebody talk about peace in the Western world?
Yeah.
It's gone from research. I can do it because I'm an independent private foundation. There's no peace research left in Scandinavia, which was a center of peace research 20 years ago. It's gone from the media. You know, the Danish prime minister gets away with saying to a journalist before she enters the synagogue to commemorate the first year of the Hamas attack. She says, if we don't look up and watch out in Denmark, Hamas will also come and take Denmark.
Yeah.
You know, you get away with saying that. And the journalist say, excuse me, did you say Hamas? No. No, the journalist just registers it, and that's it, right? And it's gone from politics. I don't know anybody who has I take the Danish Folketing, the Danish parliament, all the parties are for Ukraine, even the left-wingers. I mean, I was for 10 years a member of the Danish Disarmament Commission, the Danish government's commission in the 80s. There was nobody who had talked about arming somebody else or bombing, as Denmark has done since 2000, Denmark has been an bomber nation. Most people are not aware how much bad things Denmark, that little nice country, you know, H.E. Andersen and all that, has been doing around the world. In total blind solidarity with the United States, whether it's been Afghanistan, it's been Libya, or it's been Yugoslavia, or whatever. We've been bombing everywhere. I don't say we because I happen to be a Danish citizen, but it's not my country anymore. But peace is gone in research, politics, and media. You're speaking with a very specific person, a unique person. I'm joking now, because my commitment as a researcher is to peace by peaceful means. And people say, oh, that's very unrealistic, Jan. How can you waste your life on such a thing? That's the Charter of the United Nations that we have all signed.
Yeah, yeah. And it should be appreciated. And I appreciate you for standing up for that principle and for being so determinative in your way of conveying it during this conversation. You know, you were just talking about intellectualism.
Thank you.
And you reminded me of something. You and I were just talking about October 1962, Cuban Missile Crisis. There was and this is a sign of the times we live in. I was recently in the United States working as a journalist, and I was interviewing someone who worked at the White House. She was the press secretary for the president of the United States of America. And she turned during our interview and said, Cuban Missile Crisis. What was that? She said, Cuban Missile Crisis. And unfortunately, that lack of, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I know enough to be able to do my job. And what I don't know, I try to learn. We are filled right now, especially in the United States and especially in the West, with people like that who don't know anything. And they're sitting next to the presidents and the advisors and their cabinet members. And they anchor the evening news and their editors at major newspapers. And they don't know a damn thing about our world or even 10 years beyond what their lifespan is. That's troubling, isn't it?
It's very troubling, and that is a problem for democracy too, because you cannot have democracy functioning if you don't have knowledge. Yeah. And if you don't have public debate and you don't have free media, then it's the end of democracy. And I have said long ago, and I'd like to repeat it here, people thought earlier, myself included, that you could understand international politics by some textbooks, you know, political science, international relations, doctrine studies, and all that. Mm-hmm. A decent theoretical and conceptual work. Today, you need social psychology, psychiatry, theology, eschatology, and God knows what, but you don't, and groupthink theories, but you don't need any kind of the traditional ways, because you can't understand an administration like the Trump regime by applying normal political science concepts to it. It's too outré. It's too far away from normal behavior. Yes. And the same increasingly goes with the European Union. I'm sorry to say that. Everything I've been saying, it makes me sorry, but I still the duty of an intellectual, yes, even in the most impossible situation, to say what can be done. You know, you go to a doctor and you are told by him or her that you have cancer, and the diagnosis, the prognosis is not very good. And then you say, but doctor, what can be done? And the doctor answers you, I don't know, next patient. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
This is what intellectuals do. We waste time talking about Kaya Kallas. Mm-hmm. We waste time we could spend on how could we change the world? How could we make it better? How can we mobilize people? What vision should we have in the Western world for a better West and a better world? We are driving the world as though we were looking 99% of the time in the rear mirror of our car. Yeah. You know where you go. I don't know whether you're a car driver. I am. I love to drive cars. And I tell you, if I only looked at the rear mirror, I would have had an accident, which I so far don't have. We are spending tons of time quarreling about how to interpret. Think of all these geopolitical commentators. They are brilliant. They're totally knowledgeable. There's not one who talks about, I think we could do this or that. We could disarm. We could change the defense system. We could think differently. We could involve intellectuals and people of art and culture into political decision making. That was one of the ideas behind the welfare state, by the way. We could think of a way of sharing the world's resources. Look at Arctic now. The Arctic area would be a fantastic place to experiment with a sustainable development together with all the interested parties, and Greenland in the middle, because it's a fantastically beautiful country that Trump is now going to destroy with militarism. You know, we could change the whole thing, but everybody talks about Greenland and how bad Trump is. Yeah, I do that too. Okay, but that's diagnosis and prognosis. If you don't have therapy and treatment, you are a lousy doctor. And that's what peace research is about, because you've not done your peace research work before you've come up with some possible solution. Then people may say, let's discuss it, or they may say, this is unrealistic. But not having an idea in this situation of the world about what to do is, in my view, not morally defensible.
There you go, doctor.
Far too many have it.
You're telling it like it is. You're telling it to the world, and it's sour medicine that needs to be swallowed. And I think you're absolutely right. Let me ask you this. If people want to reach out to you, if they want to join your cause, what do they do? Instruct them.
Well, our main website, which is going to be new and collect everything we've done the last 40 years, which is 15,000 at least documents, etc., it is transnational.live.
Mm.
Transnational.live. We are a small independent foundation with 50 people around the world. We are all unpaid, and we refuse money from corporations and governments. We're only people financed. We're the last organization of that type in the world doing peace research and peace education. Secondly, we have a Substack page with 300-400 videos and articles, etc. Anybody can reach out. Anybody can subscribe. Anybody can write a mail. I try myself to answer everybody who contacts us. But, you know, asking today, you look at where the UN is with the slogan of peace by peaceful means. We are committed research-wise to peace by peaceful means. Mm. I mean, the UN is being destroyed by the world. And we survive because we are not. Nobody can kill us in the sense that, you know, you can take the budget away from us because we have never been dependent on anybody. And that's what I call free research, sir. But there's very little left on it in this world.
And I thank you for it. And by the way, I just want to warn you guys, it's transnational.live. Transnational.live. Don't you dare say.
Hey, you learned something new today.
Don't say transactional or you're going to get yelled at, you know?
Exactly. That's why I had to protest when you said transactional.
Doctor, you are a delight. I really enjoyed my
time. Thank you so much.
And I love
my pleasure to speak with you.
I love your passion. I really do. Don't change.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, you too.
We've got a lot of comments from you as usual. that we've gotten recently on my interview with the Swiss academic Pascal Lota from Kyoto University. Remember that in Japan? I had him on because he was recently hassled, almost canceled by YouTube. So let's start with Josh Dionne, who says, thanks for inviting Pascal or Pascal while you YouTube tries to make him disappear. Let's pray for him. That's nice. It's nice that you would say that. Frank Aviro says, Pascal's academic style is really a breath of fresh air nowadays. Gavin Miller says, though, what a surprise that Pascal Lota is linked to RT. Every word is tainted and tailored and not in good faith. Well, thank you, Mr. Miller. But what are you talking about? He's not connected to RT at all. He's simply a guest that we invited on the show because of his predicament with YouTube. Your criticism is hasty and it's unfair. But thank you nonetheless for commenting and continue to comment. Ibrahim says, thank you, Rick, for the great show. Keep up the good work and God bless you. Thanks, Ibrahim. That's nice. Also, KZ.7160 says, as much as I disagree with what Trump is doing all over the world, I absolutely have no sympathy whatsoever for what he's doing in Europe. I kind of agree. As usual, all the feedback is appreciated. I'm on YouTube, by the way. Check out Journalistically Speaking. Don't hesitate to speak your mind. Also, you can look for me on X and soon other exciting places. You can find me on X at Rick Sanchez TV. And we're really, really making an impact there. No, you are, actually. Speaking of you, thank you for letting me into your home. We'll look for you next time.